Good evening, and welcome to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Bob Oakes. This week, we're bringing you stories written and produced by students from last semester's Narrative Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication at Boston University. The students were asked to find an unusual job and profile the person who does it. As you might guess, the jobs varied widely, ranging from typewriter repair to teaching dogs to swim. Starting us off is a report from Matt Goisman.
At Hammersmith Studio in Concord, Mass., blacksmith Carl Close is working on a piece of a door lock. He shoves a flat iron rod into the fires of his forge, then pulls it out when it's brightly glowing and lays it on his anvil.
You have to heat the piece up in the fire and bring it to about 1,800 degrees.
Close hammers away at the molten metal, pounding parts flatter, curving other parts into a hook. When done, he shoves the rod in a large, wooden, colonial-looking bucket of water. Steam billows up as it cools. Close is 46. He's been blacksmithing since he was 8. He fell in love with the art watching his dad work in Middleton, Mass.
When I was working with my dad and I would watch the fire and the heat from the fire hit the cold air and create these waves in the air, and that was really interesting to me, so being able to take nothing and turn it into something useful, I thought was really interesting.
Close learned blacksmithing from his father, and his son learned it from him. The three have even worked together on a chandelier for a university.
My father did a lot of the mill work on it, and my son did some of the finishing, and I did a lot of the forging of the smaller parts.
Close's wife, Susan, also blacksmiths. For her, the job is all about transformation.
You're taking a medium, which is metal, and transforming it. You're taking it from one state to another state and creating a beautiful heirloom quality object.
Beyond his family, Close says he's well aware of how old blacksmithing is.
You wake up in the morning and you go to work, and the first thing you think about is, wow, I'm doing something that somebody 350 years ago did. And it's kind of a neat position to be in.
And this centuries-old profession requires a simplistic approach.
You're creating something with the tools that you made, so it just kind of brings you back into the dawn of time. The only basic tools are the anvil, the tong, pair of tongs, a hammer, and a forge. And with those tools, any blacksmith can do anything they need to do.
Close prefers those basic tools to modern ones like a balance or a straight edge. To straighten a rod, he'll just lay it on a wooden stump and hammer it until satisfied.
If you look down, you sight down, and if it looks straight, then it is straight. And that's the way things have been done for many, many, many years. And if everything was perfectly straight, it would lose its appeal, I believe.
At a time when many metalworking jobs are going overseas, Carl and Susan Close have kept their company going. That's thanks to historical restoration projects, like Alexander Hamilton's home in New York, and private contracts with wealthy arts patrons.
There are so many talented people out there, and that I would like to see most of the work stay here, because there's still blacksmiths out there that are still working like myself, and because of our pride and professionalism, I think people still want some of this type of work, and they still appreciate what we do.
Being a blacksmith requires spending hours on end in front of a raging fire, doing tough, physical labor. Still, the closest find a way to do it day in, day out. Despite this economy, they make it all work. No plans beyond the burning forge. There's just them, the job, a few tools, and the metal.
Now, here are two stories from student Grace Kwan.
Those are not computer keys you're hearing. It is the sound of a typewriter at the Cambridge Typewriter Company in Arlington. There are vintage lacquer typewriters all over the museum-like shop. Some date back to the 1800s. All shop owner Tom Furrier does is restore broken typewriters.
Typewriters are definitely making a comeback. Not a huge comeback, but that people who gravitate towards, you know, old school things, you know, we'll look at it and say, oh, yeah, I'd like to try doing my writing on that, or just, you know, keep one around the house.
When Fourier started fixing typewriters 30 years ago, the sound of clicking typewriters still ran the workplace.
Back when I started, it was before PCs, and typewriters still ran the workplace. Every office ran on Selectrix and office machines like that. That was basically the main repair. We were mostly an IBM type repair place.
Cambridge Typewriter Company was originally a typewriter rental place, but Fourier had to redefine the business to keep going. Now, he is one of the few repairmen in the Boston area who only fixes typewriters.
Younger people were getting into using typewriters again, so I just started gravitating towards learning how to repair old vintage machine, 60, 70, you know, even 100-year-old typewriters. No one else was doing that in this area. Word started spreading, so I did build up a new type of clientele over the years.
A typewriter repairman can earn from $40,000 to $50,000 a year. Fourier says he has a steady stream of daily work, thanks to service calls in downtown Boston.
A lot of companies I deal with that actually use typewriters still pretty heavily.
What kind of companies would still use typewriters?
Well, there's a lot of, believe it or not, state and federal offices that still, you know, have forms that they have to, that they're actually, by law, certain forms have to be typewritten still. A lot of funeral homes use them because death certificates have to be typewritten. Hospitals, because birth certificates have to be typewritten.
Fourier explains that the sudden peak in these vintage machines is also because customers like owning a piece of history.
I get a lot of people now that find, like, their grandparents' typewriter in the attic and think it's cool, it's a nice connection, you know, to another generation, and they'll get it cleaned up and keep it downstairs where everybody can use it.
For some customers, like John Levine, typewriters bring back memories.
I used to work at my dad's motor parts store when I was like 10 years old in the 1950s, and there was a lot of vintage office equipment around, and sort of a Proustian thing, you know, the smell of the typewriter, the ring of the bell, the roar of the ribbon. It sort of brings back memory of tongue and corned beef sandwiches eaten with my grandfather, and sort of before my life got a little more complicated.
Levine is a frequent customer of the store, bringing many of these archaic relics for Fourier to fix. He explains that the typewriter is part of a sensory and tactile experience.
Some people collect because they want to have completeness, or they want to have really rare items. But I collect typers. I want a machine that has a really good action. And so I just don't like the action on this machine. It's just got to feel right.
Ironically, it is new media that is helping keep this old technology alive. Fourier gets service calls from all over the country after setting up a blog about his passion.
Back when all this was going down in the mid-80s, I told everyone, I says, you know, I love what I'm doing. I want to keep doing it. I'm going to find a way to do it and do whatever it takes to get, you know, to keep it going. I says, I'll be the last guy standing in town. And everybody would laugh and joke about it, but now it's true.
Although the future is digital, Tom Fourier hopes to take on an apprentice and continue the legacy of the Cambridge Typewriter Company. Violins line the walls at the Rooney & Sons Violin Workshop. The atmosphere is peaceful and is filled with faint sounds of an employee tuning the violins. Jesse Mashmeyer, one of the violin restorers, is working on a violin made in Amsterdam in the 1790s.
I sometimes have a customer's instrument that needs to be glued or repaired. I have a few projects open that I'm getting ready for the showroom. Yeah, occasionally I'll have an appointment for sound adjustment.
Mashmeyer grew up playing the violin and made his first one when he was 15. He started his professional career 11 years ago when he went to study in Italy, and his skills are still constantly in demand. Luthiers, as violin makers are called, must have patience, steady hands, and attention to detail. They depend on only a few high-quality tools to handcraft these temperamental instruments.
This is a Japanese chisel. It's like the samurai steel, the laminated steel. Your tools are very important. I don't have too many, but they're used all the time.
So what makes up a good violin for a luthier?
Well, it's supposed to be easy to play and respond well and speak quickly and have some soul to it.
Performers agree and say they look for different characteristics in sound quality. Maggie Snow, a violinist from Idaho, says finding a good violin depends on the individual's preference of sound tone.
I kind of think of it as an extension of yourself. I like things that are more romantic and, like I said, very sort of buttery sounding and smooth and easier to play. And that's a good violin for me.
Changes in the weather also lead performers to bring violins to the workshop. In the winter, dry air can cause violin wood to contract and shrink, damaging the inner tensions of a violin.
It's sort of like a car. You have to keep it maintained if you want it to run well.
Being a violin restorer has some perks. Mashmeyer has come across many rare and priceless violins, such as Stradivari, Guarneri, and Amati violins.
Some of those violins are such great instruments that they don't hide any mistake you make. Sometimes I wish I could have this violin.
Do you find it hard to part with them?
In the beginning, a long restoration project, maybe 3 to 6 months, you get attached to the instrument, but then you want to get it off your bench.
To reward himself for his hard work, Mashmeyer is making his own copy of a Stradivari.
I've sold all the instruments I make, but this one I'm going to keep and play. And still finishing off the varnish. I've seen about 30 Strad violins now, so I tried to bring the style and the spirit of his style into this violin, and then I hope it sounds great.
Despite the economic crisis, violin restorers find a steady stream of work. Mashmeyer says it is because of the art and historic value of the violins.
It's such an old profession, and music is even more important in down economic times. Music and movies and things that take people out of their day-to-day grind.
And Jesse Mashmeyer looks forward to finishing his violin so he can finally enjoy performing the instrument that he truly loves.
Two stories there from student reporter Grace Kwan, and starting us off was a report from Matt Goisman. This is WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from last semester's narrative radio journalism class in the College of Communication. In a few minutes, we'll hear stories from Grace Sin and Paul Ryan. Leading us off this segment is a report from Andrew Dwyer.
Steve Davos is driving his cab in Alston. Davos is a European immigrant in his mid-40s who came to Boston 6 years ago and went to work as a cab driver.
I chose to be a cab driver because I thought it would be an easy way out to get started. I didn't have time to train myself. I have been a nighttime driver for the last 5 years, and usually nighttime is the time that mostly bad things happen.
There's no typical night for Davos, and he has lots of stories.
There are times that I feel that I'm acting like a psychologist. I would like to tell you one of the stories that has touched me more than any other story, maybe. I was on Tremont Street, and I see a woman holding a one-year-old baby in her arms, and she was just desperate. She was acting like she was a runaway.
The woman threw herself in front of the car to stop Davos and asked to go to South Station.
I realized that it was some kind of a serious situation that she was involved in. The entire trip, she was talking on the phone with her father. She said, I'm coming back home and I'm going to start my life again without him or anybody else. If you were in the cab and listening to the determination through her voice, you could cry.
The child cried as the woman asked how much was on the meter. Davos pulled up to the station and told the woman she owed him no money. Additionally, he reached into his pocket, pulled out $10, and gave it to the woman. Davos also remembers a passenger on Beacon Hill last summer, a man who had had way too much to drink.
Other cabs were driving by, they wouldn't pick him up. On a Saturday night, you don't look who is not drunk. You look, you know, I mean, everybody's drunk, so business is business. You take anybody.
The man got into the cab and asked to be taken to West Roxbury.
He told me that his girlfriend cheated on him that night, and he started crying. He started telling me that this is going to be over tonight. And I said, what do you mean it's going to be over? I sensed that he was suicidal.
As Davos continued to drive, the man pulled out a couple of pill bottles. Hearing one open, Davos was unsure of what it could be. Hoping it was a mint or a piece of candy, Davos asked if he could have one.
He says, no, you cannot have one. These are all for me. He says, they are pills. I'm going to just blow it tonight.
Remembering a cousin who committed suicide a few years ago, Davos stopped the car and talked to him. The man dumped all the pills down a nearby drain, and Davos drove him home.
When things like this happen, you should reach out and try to help. I didn't do that in order to get a better tip. Forget that. You know, money has no value when you come to an issue like that.
As a cab driver, Davos deals with serious situations like these on a regular basis. Some nights are more lighthearted than others, however. His favorite nights are the ones where he gets to drive pregnant mothers to the hospital for them to give birth.
When I participate, even for a few minutes, it makes me very happy. A baby being born, it's one of the happiest moments. I smile, no matter how sad I could be, no matter how hard my day was, that makes me happy.
Davos may not make as much as a professional therapist, but he continues to pride himself in his ability to make a positive difference in other people's lives.
It was raining hard in Frisco. I needed one more fare to make my night. A lady up ahead waved to flag me down. She got in at the light.
College student Gary Kim really likes his job.
Like, if you look at this one, it's an imagination experiment, which sounds pretty cool and it pays pretty well. It's also nice because it only takes like an hour or so, and they usually do it around your schedule, so you can really pretty much choose when you work and how much you work.
Kim is a junior at Boston University. To make ends meet, he doesn't wait tables or answer calls. Instead, he gets brain scans and has his blood drawn. He's a test subject for medical experiments. Yes, a human guinea pig.
Class is my main priority, so when I'm trying to find jobs, I try to do it around my own schedule, and I don't have to write a resume or cover letter, go through the process, and even be rejected. I can just get a job and get paid right away.
College students are usually the most attractive test subjects for researchers. Sam Tunovic is a research coordinator at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He says flexible schedules make students more dependable.
From a research coordinator standpoint, it's great. One of the most frustrating things you can have is when you have no-shows. So the frequent flyers, I think it's great. They have incentives in it, whether it's monetary or because they're interested. And for us, it's great because we have someone that's dependable.
Recruiting volunteers is more difficult when studies involve the use of unfamiliar equipment like transcranial magnetic stimulation, which uses magnetic fields to stimulate the brain. But Tunovic says there's nothing to fear.
I think what it is when people do come in, they're still a little nervous, you know. Your brain's getting stimulated. You know, the thought of that seems very sci-fi and futuristic. But once they actually start doing the study, they realize, oh, it's not that bad. But to some degree, people are turned off a little bit. But those studies usually also pay a little bit more. There's a little bit more incentive to participate.
That type of study can pay a few $100s for each visit. But better-paying jobs frequently have specific requirements, such as having asthma or living with a smoker. These jobs pay so much more, Gary Kim sometimes finds himself wishing he had more medical problems.
This one time I saw one where they were asking for a very specific type of back acne, and they were going to pay me $600, but I was kind of disappointed because, you know, I don't have back acne, but at the same time, I guess it was a good thing.
When he does qualify for a study, Kim wants to get paid. Not much can discourage him.
I know there are a lot of risks out there, but that's something I'm willing to take because I usually trust these institutions. I'm at like an Ivy League school, like at Harvard across the river or something like that, and they're all respected institutions, and nothing bad has ever happened to me. I've been doing this for a couple years.
Kim's enthusiasm is a subject of concern for many of his friends, including Grace Kim.
He's always talking about how he's doing them because he needs money. So it's kind of very concerning for me because he's kind of like given up his body for all these causes that he doesn't even know too much about just because he needs money, like financial assistance. So it's kind of very concerning for me.
Because his friends worry about his involvement in these studies, Kim chooses not to even mention his participation to his parents.
I don't really want them to know that I do these experiments because, you know, their parents, and they're going to freak out and tell me that it's dangerous, that I'm going to die or something like that.
Friends and family may be concerned about Kim's safety, but Santunovic says these fears are not necessary with today's scientific advances.
Nowadays, there's so much oversight and research. You have institutional review boards. Anything you do always has to be documented. You have to disclose everything. It's very strict in terms of what you can and can't do. So if students are turned off, they really shouldn't, because it's never been safer to participate in studies.
And without major safety concerns, Gary Kim is far from alone. Tunovic sees plenty of other people also making their livings as human guinea pigs.
That was student reporter Grace Sin. Before that, we heard a report by Andrew Dwyer. Now a story on an unusual job by student Paul Ryan.
Pulled these out this morning. This is next week's work. We've got a leopard, a lion, a bear, giraffe, a couple of brown bears. This is for next week's projects.
When you walk into Joe Petrozillo's Northeast Taxidermy Studio in Middletown, Connecticut, you're greeted by birds, deer, and even a zebra in the reception office. And then you enter the warehouse.
Here's where I store all the skins. I just pulled these out this morning. This is next week's work. All these boxes that are numbered have different skins, hides, and horns for different clients.
The back rooms look like your typical warehouse, with 16-foot high ceilings and 8,000 square feet of room to work. The only difference is that there are animals everywhere you turn.
We're a full-service taxidermy studio. We do anything from the smallest individual order to the largest African collection. I would say we're about 50-50. Half of our work is local and the other half is shipped in from Africa, Asia, or what have you.
For North American animals, just the skins are shipped, usually frozen solid in plastic bags. But getting entire animals from Africa is a bit more difficult.
They're shipped from Africa. They have to come through the port of entry where they're inspected by U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And at that point there, they clear customs and they come to me. This particular lot here is for one client. There's a hippo, crocodile, there's all kinds of trophies in here.
After the skins get back from the tannery, they're ready to be mounted over a styrofoam mannequin. Most of the clients are hunters, coming from the United States, Canada, Africa, Australia, you name it. Petrozillo stuffs everything from birds, which tend to cost a couple $100s, to a life-size elephant, which can cost upwards of $100,000. He'll do nearly any type of animal, but there's one type he will not do.
The most odd request I would say that we get is house dogs and pets and family pets, but we don't do that here.
Petrozillo's not much of a hunter himself anymore. He works more on the back end of taxidermy, making sure the animals end up looking realistic and lifelike. In fact, it's something he's wanted to do for a long time.
I started when I was 12 years old doing taxidermy. I come from a background of artists, and this is just a great fit for me. I really like the artistic part of the taxidermy, and between that and the wildlife, it worked out good for me.
There are 10 workers at Northeast Taxidermy. Most help out with every animal. Joe Petrozillo sometimes thinks about expanding the business, but he says he likes working with the tight-knit staff he has now.
A man who walks with the animals, talks with the animals, grunts and squeaks and squawks with the animals. Polynesia, just think of it. And they could talk to me.
That report by student Paul Ryan. This is WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from last semester's Narrative Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. The assignment? File a story on an unusual job. In our final segment, we're going to hear reports from Per Magnus Riesing, Gautier Giacomoni, and leading us off is Mason Sand.
One, two, three, take off.
Every plane or thing that blows up has to have something to escape from so they don't die.
These young aviators have a special role to play in the life of their aircraft. They aren't just the pilots. They also build the crafts from scratch. their building material of choice, Lego.
Here's some more wings.
This is no ordinary day in Lego class. After building their planes, the class is about to embark on the main event, a test flight through the halls of the school.
How about you? Are you excited for the flight?
Yes, I very am. And I'm starting to make you a plane.
Oh, wow, thanks.
That's what friends do, of course.
That's a 5-year-old student in class with Chandler Goodale, the Lego teacher at the Devotion School in Brookline. The Lego program at the school is part of the Devotion After School Enrichment Program, and for Goodale, offers an immediate pull to kids.
I think there's a very kind of innate quality that Legos have. It's that there's a kind of immediate constructive high that comes from it. What's happening there is they're getting that and high that we all get when two things click together.
The idea of Lego education may seem like a quirky diversion from real school subjects, but as it turns out, engaging children, particularly young children, in this kind of thinking is a matter of national concern. That's because of its connection with STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math learning. The U.S. lags far behind its global competitors in these areas, and most students and workers who excel here are white and men. One exception, though, is Sarah Chmielewski. She's an engineer in cybersecurity at MIT Lincoln Laboratory. She credits her gift for math to encouragement from her mother.
She's a pharmacist, and she always made sure that I was challenged and that I chose a career that was challenging.
There's no easy answer to questions of underachievement in U.S. STEM. But one thing is clear. For kids to embrace STEM learning, it needs to be fun. Back in the classroom, the creative high is taking hold of me, and with a little help from my new friends, I build my very own Lego plane.
Here's mine. What do you think of it?
Electric wing. I think it's great.
Yeah?
But it's a little on the short side.
It's true. It has a little, it kind of has trouble standing up, too.
It does, too.
Yeah, but did it look like it'd be fun to fly, though?
Sort of.
Okay, so it's not perfect, but I get it done in time for the most exciting part of the day, the test flight.
All right, now we're going to turn to the right. Turn to the right. Tilt to the right. Through the hall. Rocket boost.
All right, so how did that go?
Fantastic. Aircraft's probably one of my favorites, and I think we got all of our planes off the ground, and we also got all of our pieces and planes intact back in the hangar. That's a good day. That's a Roger from the cabin's tower.
For now, the questions about STEM productivity remain, but that won't stop Chandler Goodale from changing young students' lives one Lego at a time.
10, 20, 30, 40, 50 or more. The bloody red balloon was rolled up the score. 80 men died, standing in that street. Of the bloody red balloon of Germany. Not to be sworn.
The manual arts class that Bill Reynolds teaches looks and sounds like any other shop class. A concrete slab floor, an array of tools on the wall, and a couple of power tool stations. The difference here is that all of the students are blind. Reynolds runs the shop at the Cale Center for the Blind in Newton. He teaches spatial awareness and other transitional skills to people who have recently become blind. The idea is to train students who are used to relying on their vision for information to use their hands instead.
You're taking in all of your information with your hands. So, for example, if somebody is putting this piece of wood on the saw, and I have them push it all the way to the fence, and these are all things you can feel. You can locate where you are. You know that once it's back against the fence like that, the saw blade is going to cut it at a 90-degree angle.
With a piece of wood on a power miter saw, students have to align the blade with the precise location where they want the blade to cut the wood. Again, they must use their hands.
If you pull the saw right down to the wood, you can feel where that blade is going to make contact with that wood and cut through it. So now you know where you want to stay away from, and move your hand a safe distance away from that blade, plant it. So you don't move your left hand, and with the right hand, you turn on the saw, bring it down, and cut it at the same point that you left it.
Some tools require less oversight. For example, Jessica O'Connor used a drill with no supervision. She has been blind since she suffered a stroke when she was 8 months old.
Get rid of this bit to put in this bit. This bit is the countersink bit.
And what does that bit do?
It makes a bigger hole so that you wouldn't have any problems putting the head of the screw inside.
Jessica O'Connor never really used a power tool before. In fact, before taking the class, she had been forbidden from it. The first work Bill Reynolds did with the blind came back in the 70s. He made models to help a blind student understand pictures in a college textbook.
She taught me Braille so I could label her drawings for her. And we had to deal with each other's different perceptions of the world, and it was a fascinating process. She introduced me to concepts. For example, an illustration might show a profile of a face. And I said, well, do you prefer to work with the profile of a face or a face head on? And she said, that doesn't mean anything to me. I want the fullest view. So whatever would give the most information. And that to me as an artist was a very abstract concept.
That experience serves Reynolds well as he helps his students design and build a wide range of wood items.
Well, here's a birdhouse for a screech owl. Here's somebody made a pirate's chest with a barrel vaulted top. Somebody made a Native American flute. It's a two-chambered flute. So the first chamber captures the air, equalizes the pressure, so you get a nice equal tone out of it.
In all the years of the Carroll Center's woodworking program, there's only ever been one accident, and that was a teacher who suffered only a minor injury.
That report from student Gautier Giacomoni. Our final look tonight at unusual jobs comes from Per Magnus Riesing.
Hi, how are you?
Good, I'm Kirsten.
Kirsten, Alex, it's
Hi,
a pleasure.
Alex,
how are you?
This is Harley.
Harley, what's going on? Oh, tell me, is there anything I need to know about Harley before he gets in the water?
He loves the water.
Loves the water.
In South Boston, a business that caters to pets is the Red Dog Pet Resort and Spa. It's the size of almost 10 basketball courts. Here, pets can be groomed, cleaned, cut, exercised, and massaged. They can listen to music, they can watch Animal Planet on flat screen TVs, or take swimming lessons.
It's all good. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Has he ever been in a pool before versus the beach?
He's been in fountains.
the kind he's not supposed to be
yeah.
in?
he loves the water. It's hard to keep him out of large pools of things, but never, like, actually. He has been in a lake.
Okay, cool.
And, like, jumped off a dock.
Okay,
and stuff
okay
like
so
that.
That's the thing. He's okay with jumping off of surface.
Yeah.
Water.
Yeah.
All right, and how old is he?
He's 2.5.
Awesome. Today is the day of two.
The pet swim instructor is Alex Figueroa. For 20 years, he has been a personal trainer and swimming coach for two-legged clients. He began also working with four-legged clients after a visit to Red Dog to pick up supplies for his pets.
I saw the pool. I was like, this is great. It'd be a nice way to kind of apply what I was teaching people to dogs.
Figueroa pitched the idea of a fitness swim for dogs. The dog spa operators liked it.
If you think about it, the swim mechanics for people are exactly the same as swim mechanics for canines. It's exactly the same. If I were to put a diagram up and put the five key points out, or the three key points for a human, they would be exactly the same as the three key points for dogs. And everyone kind of looks at me funny, like, well, don't dogs naturally know how to swim? It's like, yeah, well, dogs in the natural do, because they naturally are in those environments.
On the walls around the pool, there are dog life jackets in Chihuahua and St. Bernard sizes. The pool itself looks like an oversized hot tub. Harley, the black lab who loves big pools, hesitates. But Figueroa starts bouncing a ball off the wall and into the water. Other dogs don't need any encouragement, like chocolate Labrador Max. Then there is Carlitos, a 13-year-old Shih Tzu. Carlitos is here for rehabilitation after an operation. But there is another issue. At 13 years old, he has never been in the water. Carlitos started with a life jacket on, but now it's off. It's progress, but Carlitos isn't thrilled. Finally, Carlito's nightmare is over. It's back to Mom and Dad, who have been watching through the glass windows in the lobby.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
For him.
All right.
Thank you.
He did very well. Even took the vest off, so that was good.
Carlito's parents, Rosa Maria Olortegui and Eli Ullen, are pleased.
He's an older dog. He's 13, and he has a little bit of arthritis in his lower back and back legs. But I think he did great in the water. Hopefully, it will help him.
Are you going to come back?
Oh, absolutely. We've already scheduled an appointment for next Saturday.
I actually watched the videos on the Red Dog website, and I thought, oh, my Lord, this is going to be very fun for him to do, and that may help a little bit with the pain also.
How much did it cost?
It's $25.
Think it's worth it?
I think it's, of course it's worth it, yes.
I don't know. You'd just be amazed at the lengths people go to make their pets happy. I mean, I'm the same way. Like, I have my two dogs, and those dogs, those are my family. So you take care of them. I mean, just like you would buy the top-of-the-line stroller for your kid, you know, cause, or you go out and you buy, like, the top-of-the-line car to make sure your kid's safe and all. You know, these dogs, this is your family.
Alex Figueroa enjoys his job. It's been educational, he says. Although his body is pretty scratched up, he has never been bitten. And Figueroa says his furry clients actually listen better than his human ones do.
Swimming in the swimming hole, when days are hot and days are cold in the swimming hole.
Student reporter Per Magnus Reason, bringing to a close tonight's special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from last semester's Narrative Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. Our student contributors were, in order of appearance, Matt Goisman, Grace Kwan, Andrew Dwyer, Grace Sin, Paul Ryan, Mason Sand, Gautier Giacomoni, and Per Magnus Rizek. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's stories were edited by Associate Professor of Journalism Ann Donahue. Our program was produced by Mark Egon, with help from Mike Toda and Michael Garth. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Bob Oakes. Thanks for joining us.